Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Gail Jenner is a former secondary history and English teacher and is married to a fourth-generation cattle rancher in the mountains of Northern California. She and her husband live on the 150-year-old original homestead. She has spent 46 years working with her husband while maintaining a large garden, working outside the home, raising children and chickens, cooking for family and hired help, and now writing full-time. She is the author of Ankle High and Knee Deep and other titles. She's an avid cook and gardener and has sold recipes to Better Homes and Gardens, Every Day with Rachel Ray, Country Woman, and A Taste of Home. And a family recipe was recently included in The Cowboy's Cookbook, Recipes and Tales from Campfires, Cookouts, and Chuck Wagons. Gail Jenner, welcome.
Hi.
Now, your book is, it seems to me, part history book and part recipe book.
Yes.
What would you say, is it? Are they equal parts?
I think it started out more as a recipe book, but as I began to investigate the recipes, I couldn't run away from the history. So I sort of changed the format or expanded the format that had originally been promoted by my editor and began to include more and more history.
Because I could see how if you're talking about recipes for presenting recipes for apple pies, it might be, well, maybe I'll provide the listener with some history of apples.
Mm-hmm.
Or a lot of times it's a person. Mm-hmm. Because you've collected these recipes from real people,
yes.
And you tell us who this person was that you got this recipe from. So you did major in history, so I could see how that would be of interest to you to present a book that is both history and a collection of recipes. So when you're doing this, how did you decide? Did you just see where your interest led you? How did you decide what history to incorporate in your book?
Well, the editor sort of gave me a wide lens and said, whatever fits your research, go with it. And they've been wonderful to deal with that way. And so as I began to interview people and ask for recipes and query other people, and they sent me wonderful recipes plus wonderful family stories, I thought, you can't really separate the recipes from the people. And then when I would trigger some kind of thought, for instance, early magazines or early cookbooks, it seemed too interesting to leave out. And I just felt it was important history and history that most of us don't think about. So that's why I went with a lot of different sorts of sidebars.
And photographs. I really enjoyed your photographs. The cover has a beautiful color picture of apples and this baked item. And so I enjoyed those pictures, but there were also vintage pictures, mm-hmm. of families. And I would look at a picture of this woman in her wedding dress, and I thought, oh, that looks like a photograph of my grandmother in her wedding dress. Mm-hmm. So I identified with some of these people, like, oh, family members of my own.
Yes, I think that was one of the things that I enjoyed most. I love vintage photography, and the people were wonderfully generous. There were some photos I didn't get to include because we had a limit. So I didn't get to include a lot of the photos I would have liked to have included.
Well, one of the first ones, maybe it's the second one in your book, you have a picture of wagon train, and you said on wagon trains heading west, cooking utensils and foodstuffs were in short supply, which made creativity and resourcefulness two important commodities. And I looked at this picture, I looked at the wagon trains, I looked at the horses and mules, and I looked for women in this photograph, and I couldn't find a one. These are all men.
I know. I had a hard time finding photos that I could use without copyright issues, and I liked the photograph because of the environment and the way it stopped.
There are no there's one building off in the distance, but you have a feeling that these people are out setting up their camp. And there's a tent there, setting up camp for their wagon train. and maybe the women were off.
They might have been.
So I enjoyed the photographs in your book. Now, the vintage photographs, I noticed you said this photograph was courtesy of you, mm-hmm. Gail Jenner. But the contemporary photographs were by a photographer in your family.
Yes, my daughter, Patricia. She has always loved photography, and she has done some remarkable photography for her family. And when they asked me to do photography of the cooked items, I thought, what a wonderful opportunity for her, because she has a beautiful camera, far better than mine. And I said, come on, this is an opportunity for you to fly a little bit.
And you also add that your daughter is a lover of history, genealogy, and family stories.
Yes, yes.
So I'm sure this book project was right up her alley.
It was.
Well, you mentioned a history of cookbooks.
Yes.
You mentioned the various history notes that you have. And what did you learn when you researched early cookbooks?
Well, first of all, the first cookbooks actually came with a lot of the people who immigrated primarily from England and so forth. They called them receipts, not recipes, which I always found interesting. And there were some early cookbooks, but those weren't the ones that fascinated me. Most of the cookbooks that I found fascinating were the ones that came right before the Civil War and then following the Civil War, and that's when cookbooks sort of took off. Two of the cookbooks that I researched, one that I located and was able to purchase a copy of, were by two black former slave women, and one of them went to San Francisco and became very, very famous, Abby Fisher, and she wrote a cookbook, and she was regaled in San Francisco, and people had her cook for them and for sort of the upper echelon of society. The other lady actually put together her cookbook as a way to earn money. She was a single woman. And so the enterprising ability of these women to pursue that, I thought, was fascinating.
The title of Abby Fisher's book was quite a mouthful.
Yes.
But very specific. Well, how did you go about finding these cookbooks? Or you say you actually have a copy of Abby
yes.
Fisher's cookbook.
And it's available online. And it was a PDF version of it, but it is available for download. So you can just research her name and it'll come up. And I wanted to get a physical copy because I love physical books. But it does have a download, and that's what I did, was I took that download.
My guest is Gail Jenner, and her latest book is Sourdough Biscuits and Pioneer Pies, the Old West Baking Book. So you actually have had access to some of these old cookbooks. And in addition to the cookbooks, you tell us about the magazines that some of them are still publishing today.
Yes, yes. Red Book, and a lot of them came much earlier than we, most of us realize. And, of course, the women's early ladies magazines were more about, I think, lifestyle, et cetera, and recipes. But then some of them changed their focus as time went on.
Well, you mentioned that Red Book was started in May of 1903. It was first a literary magazine, and then it was first Red Book Magazine, and then just Red Book. And then Good Housekeeping was founded in 1885, and then it had quite a circulation. By 1911, 300,000
yes.
circulation. Yeah, in fact, you mentioned that in your book, because you say that Good Housekeeping advocated for pure food,
mm-hmm.
which actually helped influence the passage of the 1906 Pure Food and Drug Act.
Right.
And then in 1909 is when they introduced the famous Good Housekeeping Seal of Approval.
Yes.
And that exists to this day. And you have a nice photograph of the September 1915 edition of Red Book, the Red Book magazine, at 15 cents.
And that copy is actually one that my husband's family had at the house.
An actual copy?
Yes. Well, we have a number of them. So I made a scan of that and included it.
And there's a lovely lady on the cover with a hairdo that we think of as being associated with 1915. And then there's a magazine that has a lady, the photograph of the cover. This magazine And she's wearing a walking dress.
Yes.
So these magazines had fashion, mm-hmm. as well as of interest to somebody who's researching cooking, early cooking. So you include the rise of magazines, and then you get into what kind of cooking utensils they had available to them. And one of the first ones is a very versatile cooking item, and what was that?
That was the Dutch oven. Yes, and it was one that was exceptionally important on the trail because you could do it over an open fire, or you could pile on and cover up the Dutch oven with coals or hot bricks, and they could bake, they could sauté, they could steam. It was an extremely important category of utensil, and it's one that actually, if you go online and start looking, and I have a... one that I use, but there are a lot of Dutch oven cookeries and people who are still replicating the Dutch oven. And of course, when you're out in the mountains, a Dutch oven is still very useful.
Well, I have to tell you, it was mouthwatering to think of one of your first recipes, Dutch oven buttermilk cornbread, baking bread in a Dutch oven.
Yes.
And people probably don't realize they could do that today even easier on their home stove.
Yes.
But people don't.
No, we
do
don't.
Do you?
I haven't done Dutch oven. Well, I have done Dutch oven cornbread. And cornbread is one of the earliest forms of bread that especially the pioneers used, because corn was something that they could travel with very easily and reconstitute. And it was a very versatile grain that they used.
So you include a recipe for the cornbread that can be cooked in a Dutch oven. And then you also, and then that leads you into, well, what was the Dutch oven made of, and why was it such a desirable material for use in cooking?
Cast iron is not only sturdy and hardy, it can go on an open flame, or it can go on a stovetop or some kind of cooking, setup. And also the heat distributes very well in a cast iron. And we use cast iron all the time. I have at least 5 cast iron pans.
And I'm sure one of those is a Dutch oven.
Yes.
Well, you mentioned you include Dutch oven biscuits, Dutch oven peach dessert, and all this in the section of a Dutch oven, a cast iron Dutch oven. And then you have tips on using yeast, mm-hmm. your section of bread, biscuits, rolls, and muffins. And you have this nice photograph of this lady in a typical dress at the time with a little gold medal flour bag.
Yes.
And why was it called gold medal?
They won a gold medal, and so they began to market it. I mean, it was a great marketing device, and they have used it ever since.
So this lady is sitting there with a bag of gold medal flour, and you make suggestions for how to use yeast in its various forms. And then you include a photograph of Ashland Mills, mm-hmm. in Ashland, Oregon. And what was that a photograph of? What is in that picture?
It's the farmers bringing the grain to the mills. And that then they would have ground it, of course, milled it, and then returned it either to them, because if they had an agreement to take it back, or they would have sold it to various outlets.
I'll continue my conversation with author Gail Jenner after a break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. And I'm here with my guest, Gail Jenner, who has written a book, Sourdough Biscuits and Pioneer Pies, the Old West Baking Book. You know, I've seen photographs of the mill in Chico, here on Chico Creek, not far from where the studios are for North State Public Radio.
Well, and that would have been the natural place because they would have used the water power to generate the power for the millstones. There's a wonderful, wonderful mill up in Eagle Point, Oregon, and the Butte Mill, and it has been running continuously since 1872, and their millstones are huge, and they're from France. They're gorgeous. Unfortunately, the mill burned down about 3 years ago, and they are now, the whole area has pitched in, and they are now rebuilding it. But it was the original, and it's an amazing place, and the people that own it have done a great job of restoring, just bringing it to its, you know, historic appearance. So,
I recall as you say this that I once spent the night in a bed and breakfast that had been a mill in France.
Oh, wow.
This was in France, and it had been an old mill, and so they had it so that you could wander around and look at the old mill. You have a lot of terms that people might not be familiar with. For example, you have a recipe for bannock fry bread.
Yes.
Now, we can imagine what fry bread is, but bannock?
Well, that was one of the terms. And, of course, different tribes had different names for it.
But tribes of Native Americans,
yes. And this one came out of Washington. She's a writer friend of mine, Carmen. And her family has been making fry bread for at least a couple of generations.
In fact, you mentioned her name was Carmen. Carmen learned to make fry bread from a tribal elder.
Mm-hmm.
So this recipe, and you have a lovely photograph of that that she gave you, but it also, the appearance of it in the photograph looks to me like breads from India, that are baked. And so it looks similar to that because other cultures have similar breads, for example, just by different names.
Yes.
And so you could, this would be a very versatile bread, I would think. And you say that bannock is a form of flat bread that's been made pretty much the same way for centuries and still popular today. And you mentioned that Carmen, the source of this recipe, according to her, her husband's grandmother has made it for nearly every large meal and every holiday. And, of course, it's like any bread. It's flour, baking powder, water, salt, and lard.
Yes.
Gail, do modern-day Americans balk when you say lard?
Unfortunately, yes. A lot of people do balk at the idea of lard. But I have come to enjoy lard. Partly, and it's one of the things that I did a sidebar on, our cattle ranch, we used to raise hogs, but the family has processed hogs for over 140 years. And in fact, we're going to start next week doing it again, and we used to separate and render our own lard. And lard is really not as bad as people make it out to be, and it's a wonderful cooking ingredient. It's flavorless, and it makes the dough extremely malleable, and making a pie crust with lard.
And it won't stick either.
No,
as opposed to something like oil, vegetable oil, where something would stick. Mm-hmm. So that these are the advantages of lard. In fact, you have photographs of this process of sausages hanging from the hogs, and some utensil tools for scraping the hair off the skin.
Yeah.
Now, were you, I guess you grew up with it, so maybe you weren't squeamish.
No, I didn't grow up with it, though. I was raised in the Bay Area and graduated from Chico, married my husband, and started a whole new life.
And so it was tradition in his family to butcher the hogs. And you found you could participate?
Definitely participate. In the early years of beginning of our marriage, I used to do what we call scraping the guts for the casings for the sausage. However, now, because time is, of course, of the essence for all of us, we now purchase casings that have already been cleaned. But that was my job. It was an easy job, but it was pretty time-consuming. You know, you'd wash and rinse and scrape and wash and rinse and scrape and turn inside out and over and keep rinsing them. But I suppose because I entered into it with the understanding that life is really, I don't know, about everything, life and death, and I didn't squirm. I never did. Mm-hmm. And I just really welcomed entering into this lifestyle.
You also include a photograph of a smokehouse.
Yes.
And it brought back memories of generations past in my own family that in their backyard they had a smokehouse.
Right.
And it didn't, at the time I didn't think about it, but now I think, wow, they had their own smokehouse in their own backyard.
Yes.
So you, what do you do with the products after you butcher the hogs?
What we do is you kill the hogs, you clean them, clean, 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 clean. They're very clean. Hang them, and then you cut them up. And when you cut up the hams or the hocks, you put them first in a brine, keep them all clean, and then you hang them in the smokehouse. You also salt them down first and then rinse the salt off and then, as I said, hang them in the smokehouse. And then we freeze them, obviously. But we make all of our own bacon, sausage, hams, and that's what we use all year round.
Well, hogs were very convenient.
Yes.
Because they don't take as long to be ready for butchering. They'll eat anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could see how that would be very... a very useful animal on a farm, on a ranch, which is where you live.
Yes.
Currently.
Yes, I think pigs and obviously hogs are easy to maintain. They reproduce quickly. You can get 3 litters in a year if you push it. And I think for the pioneers, it was a wonderful way to have a constant source of meat and protein. And butchering didn't take long. It wasn't like a beef. Plus, with no refrigeration, they would have to salt it down, and that's why ham and bacon were easily kept. And they might keep them in a cold room hanging for quite a while, but they normally butchered in the cold months, and then, you know, it was easy keeping.
My guest is Gail Jenner, and her latest book is Sourdough Biscuits and Pioneer Pies, The Old West Baking Book. And it's part history, part recipes. And she mentions a couple of kinds of flatbread. I mentioned the banyan. There's also, you include a recipe for Norwegian flatbread. And then when you get to cornbread, you have a recipe that's called Johnny Cake. And is that different from cornbread?
It's a little less, there's fewer ingredients, but I think it's just a little bit more basic, not as sweet. And it was something that Johnny Cake is usually cooked or often cooked in a cast iron. It's not as cake-like. It's a little rougher, coarser cornbread.
Because you mentioned that in the South, there was little or no added wheat, whereas in the North, they mm-hmm. would add sweetener to their cornbread. And I'm partial to the unsweetened cornbread
right.
because if I want dessert, I want it separate.
Right.
I want the cornbread not to be sweet. So you have some recipes for that. And there's also one of my favorite forms of cornbread, if you want to call it bread, is spoon bread. It's called bread, but describe spoon bread.
Well, it was obviously a lot easier to use. It's almost like a steam bread, and then you can just spoon it out and eat it that way versus, you know, cutting it and having it as dry.
And the eggs make it moist. And
yes.
Almost, I wouldn't say custard, but...
It has more of a custard-like texture.
Than the crumbly kind mm-hmm. of cornbread that most people think of as cornbread. then you also include how to make butter mm-hmm. in your book. And... Do you have experience making butter yourself?
Well, we did. We used to make butter quite a bit. We had a dairy cow that my husband milked twice a day for many years. So we had lots of cream, lots of baking because we had so much cream, and then we would make butter. and render it out. It was fun, but it's not something that I do traditionally anymore. But on the trail, it was interesting how they let butter separate. I mean, the cream separate. They actually
rise to the top.
Yes, they would actually a lot of times put it in a barrel, and as they were moving, it would shake itself and sort of you
the
know,
movement of the wagon yes, would yes, churn the butter.
Would churn the butter.
Well, some years ago, my husband and I decided we were going to give up city life and move to the country. And so our back-to-the-earth phase, we thought, okay, where do we go? We have no country skills, if I want to call them that. And so we picked out a place where people did. We knew people that made their own soap, who, of course, churned their own butter and raised their own chickens. So, and of course, had gardens. So we wanted to go in an area where we could look out the window and see when the neighbor planted, sprinkled out his spinach seeds. Okay, it's time to plant spinach. But I didn't make my own butter. I did make my own yogurt. But there was a lady that was busy from the time the sun came up till it went down, milking the cow, pouring it through cheesecloth. There was no homogenized, pasteurized. And she would make her own butter, which is what we got for the butter. And so that's why I was wondering if you were familiar with this process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you have to get it really clean. You have to rinse it enough or else it will go rancid more quickly. So, you know, obviously these women were pretty skilled at it. We can be a lot more careless because we do have refrigeration, but they had to work. And, of course, butter would go rancid anyway a lot of the time.
And, in fact, you mentioned the effect on children were particularly vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
And you said they even would die, have been known to die from milk sickness.
Yes. What would happen is when women finished nursing, and it could have been when they're 1 year, 2 years, 3 years old, especially in the summertime and when the humidity was high, and they would put them on cow's milk, and because it wasn't pasteurized, they would oftentimes get ill. And they didn't understand what it was, and they would call it milk fever, milk, the bacteria was obviously what would, you know, kill these children. And I do know that in my own family, my great-grandmother, out of 9 children, only 3 lived to be adults. She lived in Kentucky and Missouri, I believe, and they lost 6 children to what they called milk fever.
Mm. Well, when you're talking about butter and being fresh
yes.
butter, I loved your quote by James Beard, and maybe people that are familiar with James Beard, and he once wrote, "Good bread is the most fundamentally satisfying of all foods, and good bread with fresh butter, the greatest of feasts." And it's interesting that I came across your quote from James Beard just within a day of the fact that I was eating fresh bread from the bakery. I don't bake my own bread anymore, and fresh butter. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is so simple, but there's nothing tastier mm-hmm. than fresh bread and fresh butter.
I agree, and I think that when you look around at cultures, everybody has some form of bread, whether it's a flat bread without yeast or, you know, a bread with yeast. But there does seem to be something very basic about bread, and maybe it's the idea of it being manna, you know, but very special.
My guest is Gail Jenner, and she and her family live on a ranch that has been in the family for 150 years, several generations. Her newest book is Sourdough Biscuits and Pioneer Pies, the Old West Baking Book. And we've been talking about the various recipes for things to be baked. But also you, and I mentioned in the introduction that you have experience feeding people who work on a ranch.
Yes. I cook a lot.
That must be a whole different way of cooking. If you have to cook for a bunch of people who are going to be hungry,
mm-hmm.
how many people would you typically cook for, if there is such a thing as typical?
Well, for us, it is fairly typical because we are a family operation, and it's presently 3 generations. And when we have hired hands occasionally, then we'll add them to the mix. But there is at least 5 to 6 that would come in for lunch on a pretty hungry day, especially in the wintertime. And when I was working full time, I was a lot more abbreviated in what I would cook. But generally,
now, I was imagining this meal in the middle of the day.
Yes.
And if you're working full time, how did you do that?
What I would do is have something in the deep well, what I call a deep well, because we have an old stove, but or in the oven. I'd make a dessert ahead of time. And the guys are pretty good about pulling things together as well. It's not like I do it all every day. Mm. But probably 2 to 3 days out of the week, I pretty much cook a pretty big noon meal. And they call that dinner. It's dinner. Mm-hmm. And then supper, of course, is in the evening. Yes.
The main meal is dinner, whether mm-hmm. it's noon or evening. Yeah, that would be dinner. Oh, my. You also include tips for baking. For example, you have baking better bread. And what do you say is a good tip for baking better bread?
Well, when kneading, use only enough flour to work the dough. You don't want to overwork bread or things like pie dough because it just gets tough. It takes out a lot of the elasticity and the character.
Which is what you want if you want your bread to rise.
Yes.
And not be dense.
Correct.
Then you want to develop the gluten, which yes. allows it to rise. You also say that you had to translate, and that was your word, a recipe that may be only a paragraph long,
mm-hmm.
and you had to figure out, well, okay, well, what does this person mean in this recipe?
That was one of the real challenges, but turned out to be a lot of fun, although I started to panic after a while because I had so many recipes. A lot of times the women would simply put cook in a very hot oven until done.
Which didn't tell you what temperature of the oven
right.
or how long to cook it.
Right.
So you had to kind of be a little mind reader there. Okay, what is a very hot oven or what is a slow oven or what is a moderate oven?
Correct.
And so you came up with the temperatures for those to include in your recipes. And then cook until done?
Yes. A lot of that was experimental cooking, and I had some disasters. But a lot of times it was simply because I hadn't either measured correctly or I hadn't used, the proper translation as far as degree or time. And so a lot of the recipes took time to rework. Some of the recipes were much easier because they were similar to recipes I've done myself. So I was able to translate some of those principles.
Now, you mentioned that you had a lot of recipes. Could you fit them all into this book?
No. I could easily do a volume two. People were so wonderful about sharing. And, for instance, one woman, she's a good friend, her great-grandmother's cookbook was probably 4 or 5 inches long and about 3 inches wide and was all handwritten in pencil. And she shared that with me. And I only used a couple of her recipes, but I would love to have gone back and included more, and then her grandmother's, and then recipes from both sides of the family. And I had a lot of people do that, share multiple recipes.
In fact, you have a lot of family histories in there. You'd have page, say, about the recipe collector.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had people sharing their family history with you.
Yes.
If they had a family member who contributed a recipe, you included their history.
Yeah, and that was fun, too, because a lot of these were people that they hadn't even known, grandmothers or great-grandmothers, and so they were searching their own family histories.
After a break, I'll be back with my guest, North State writer Gail Jenner. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Thank you.
I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio.
Well, I mentioned that you had a recipe for baking better bread. You have tips for baking better pies.
Yes.
And what are some of your, because that was rather lengthy. And I was particularly interested because at Thanksgiving, people who maybe don't bake pies typically, usually, will bake a pie for Thanksgiving. So what are some of your tips for baking better pies?
Well, the most important one is you don't overknead pie dough. And you want to use cold butter or cold lard. I do use butter, or if you use something like Crisco, which actually has been around since, 1911, I think, it needs to be cold, and you can refrigerate it. And the reason that is important is because that's what makes a flaky crust, is having that cold lard or butter. And then you don't want to overknead it, and you don't want to over-roll it. You want to move quickly.
You mentioned Crisco.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a kick out of your history of how that product came about. Who would have thought that these two guys, and you might tell us then what.
Well, they were brother-in-laws. And one was from Ireland, I believe, and one was from England. And they the father-in-law said, you need to develop a business. And at first they were, they were looking into...
Because their Procter. Occupation had nothing to do with food.
No.
What were their occupations?
Let's see. One was a chemist, and
I think that was the next generation.
The next generation. Okay, candle maker and a soap maker. Yes.
Yeah. So one of these guys, Procter & Gamble.
Yes.
One was a candle maker and one was a soap maker.
Right. And they married sisters, and then of course, as I said, the father-in-law told them to establish a business, and they. Yeah, they were trying to compete against other soap and candle makers, and they began to, James Gamble, the son of the founder, was a chemist, and he developed an inexpensive but mild and long-lasting white soap.
And that white soap should ring a bell with people.
Yes, ivory.
Yes, you don't see ads for it nowadays, but, and what was so wonderful about ivory soap?
Well, it would float, and not only that, but the... Interesting about the name was that it came out of the Bible, and
I was surprised to read that.
I was
your book.
Too. When I found that out, I thought that was a fascinating little piece of trivia, but interesting.
Yeah. Well, so, what did the Bible have to say about ivory?
It had to do with the. It was the palace. Yeah, it was the palace, and it was as white as ivory, and. Anyway, so
ivory soap came from this reference in the Bible about a palace as white as ivory.
Yeah, and the fact that they came up with this vegetable shortening.
So
yeah, 1911.
These two guys, that a candle maker and a soap maker, came up with this food product.
Mm-hmm. And obviously Procter & Gamble has become, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of products since then.
Well, and you have tips for improving your cake baking. And in that section about cakes, I know that putting potato in flour and breads is very nice. But you have a recipe, you can put potato in cake frosting.
Yeah.
That came as a surprise.
Well, I think because it has that texture that you can use it as a binding, which, a lot of butter or
frosting.
Yeah, the frosting you would require.
And then you had a section, this recipe happened to have been for a mayonnaise cake, and that doesn't sound too appealing, mayonnaise cake. But toward the end of that, you mentioned licking the bowls. The person who contributed the recipe, what did she say?
Well, she said it was so good you had to you had to lick the bowl when you were done. But the thing about mayonnaise, actually, is that it's basically oil and egg. And so it's a
couple of ingredients already that go into cakes, oil and egg. But when I read that, I thought, so I wasn't the only kid that liked to lick the bowl when my mother baked cakes.
No, my grandkids still like to lick the bowl.
Well, another history you include of food product, in addition to, say, something like Crisco, was chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
And more specifically, a chocolate that is well known in the Bay Area.
Ghirardelli, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And he went down to South America to try and, you know, market his product. And so, it was funny when the Ghirardelli, they, the way they broke it down so that people could spell it was...
yeah, because that's a strange word.
Yes.
And I was amused by the fact that he decided to change his first name,
yes,
to Domenico instead of Domingo.
Yes.
And how far back does chocolate go?
Well, chocolate goes back to Aztecs.
So it didn't
Mayans.
Start with Ghirardelli.
No, the cocoa, and it was a food of kings. It was a food of gods. And it was a very, very important food
from Middle America.
From Middle America, yes.
And it made its way back to Europe.
Yes.
And so here's this explorer sending back, not gold and silver, sending chocolate back to Spain.
Yes.
And then the French get wind of it and say, oh, we want some of that.
Yes. And then also the Dutch were involved in processing, you know, the chocolate to be used. And then in 1847, the British Chocolate Company introduced the first solid chocolate.
So a chocolate bar.
Yes. So that's sort of interesting that it's been around for a while.
Yeah, I can see why. I'm quite a fan of chocolate myself. But there's something that people are not particularly fond of. In fact, there are jokes about fruitcake.
Oh, yes. Fruitcake. Yes. Doorstops and all kinds of things. Yes. Anything but fruitcake.
And this goes back to now, this was amusing. In the 1700s, you say in your book, in the 1700s, fruitcake, which is also known as plum cake, was banned because it was considered sinfully rich.
Yes, sinfully rich. And then also it was used almost as a fertility for the fertile harvest and the production, and you weren't supposed to eat it until the next year's harvest and so forth.
So you save, like Queen Victoria.
Yes, Queen Victoria.
You save that fruitcake for a year.
Yes, yes.
And then it was considered sinfully rich, so it got banned. You go into the history of condensed milk because, mm-hmm. again, milk was so perishable, and then it was developed a way of condensing milk, sweetening it, so that you could open a can of condensed milk wherever you might need food, and it was mm-hmm. very convenient. So you go into the history of...
Well, and canned milk was very important during the Civil War because, it was not perishable, and they could store it and, you know, carry it with them. And I don't know if you remember this, but my grandmother used to use canned milk in her coffee because she...
Oh, yeah, it makes perfect sense.
You know,
and I've known people in a pinch would put sweetened condensed milk, because then you get the cream and the sugar. There's so much in your book that is fun. The history is fun. The recipes are fun. And you learn about sourdough. Of course, that's in the title of your book. Thank you so much for
coming in,
Gail.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
My guest has been Gail Jenner. Her latest book is Sourdough Biscuits and Pioneer Pies, the Old West Baking Book. Before and after the Second World War, when women were typically limited to the home, hospital, or schoolhouse, anthropologist Valaine Smith was traveling the globe by plane, train, boat, and automobile. From the caves of France to the bazaars of India, this retired Chico State professor was not only exploring the world, but charting the unknown territories of tourism anthropology. A current exhibition at the Valaine Smith Museum of Anthropology tells the story of her pioneer life as a world traveler and tourism scholar. Much of the student-curated exhibition is based on her recently published autobiography, Stereopticon, Entry to a Life of Travel and Tourism Research. Valaine Smith, welcome. Well, you wrote this book, and on the cover of your book, you have a little contraption that I'm familiar with, but I'm not so sure younger people would even know what that is on the cover of your book. What is that?
It's a stereopticon. It's a device intended to transfer limited pictures to three dimensions by having two set side by side, and you then view it through a viewer, and there it brings to life in full three dimension the scene represented. It's an interesting device. It developed early, I suppose, in the latter part of the 19th century. I stumbled across it because during the the Depression years in the 1930s, living in Los Angeles, we walked downtown once a week for groceries, and on the way back stopped by the Los Angeles Public Library. They had a very large children's room. It was beautifully decorated, and I became a favorite student there among many, but they were kind to me. Apparently, they trusted me. They allowed me to take home a stereopticon and 10 pictures each week. Then the next week, I'd return the old pictures and fetch 10 more. And through that device, in the next several years, I saw most of the world in three dimension while lying on the sofa on which I slept during our tiny apartment.
So this device, a stereopticon, played a role in your youth.
Indeed.
Well, you know, you're talking about you being a student, going to the library. And I noticed how many times in your book, in your life, something that sounded like it was bad news would turn into something good. And I thought of that when you, as a student, enrolled in the seventh grade, and you weren't learning anything. And you told your mother, you know, I'm not learning anything. And so your mother went to talk to the school, and she says, you know, my daughter's not learning anything. And he replied, well, we have no expectations of seventh graders at this public school. No expectations.
I know. My mother was furious.
So what turned out, though, to be something, well, oh, my gosh, what's she going to do? She says, it's the school where they don't value, they don't expect seventh graders to learn. But it turned out to be something really good, because then what did your mother do?
She went down the street to a private school and somewhat timorously went in and said, do you ever take private students, scholarship students? And they said, why don't you bring your daughter over? We'd like to meet her.
Because this was a time when nobody had much money, and affording a private school was not something that you logically expect. But your mother was very ingenious in that regard, and she says, well, but what about a scholarship? What about what year was this?
That was 1939. I believe that I transferred over there and graduated from the school in 1942 with BA, or not a BA, no, the end of senior year.
Well, the your parents, you were born on Valentine's Day. And I thought it was interesting that for the first 6 years of your life, they just called you sweetheart. Which makes sense. You're born on Valentine's Day. But by the six years old, you kind of needed a name.
I needed a name desperately. I knew that I would be ridiculed by boys on the campuses, even in elementary school. The kids were pretty sophisticated even then. And I felt I must have a name. So I got my folks together, and we met over the dining table that night, the night before school started, and I said very firmly, I must have a name.
You know, I've heard of people waiting for a little while after a baby's born before they decide on a name, but 6 years I think is about the longest I've ever heard of a child going without a name. My guest is Valaine L. Smith. And if that name is familiar, it's because that's the name on the Anthropology Museum on the Chico State campus. Valaine, as I calculated, you've actually taught for 60 years. These are college students now. So you've prepared yourself at a young age, and you started your career as a college teacher quite young.
True. I was just 20. And that was difficult because when I went into my first class that morning, I felt quite sure of myself. I had a nice bachelor's degree from UCLA. I knew my subject matter. I opened the door and I looked in, and there sat 50 men. They were all home from on the war. They'd been everywhere. They looked at me. They kind of chuckled a little bit. They still thought I was to be the professor and teach them something. And they'd been everywhere in the world, and I'd been nowhere outside much of California.
At that point in your life.
At that point.
But you know what? This caught my eye. This in your book, your sequence, learn, earn, yearn.
Yes.
So you had this period of learning, and then you graduated. You were able to earn enough money then to satisfy your yearnings.
Exactly.
And your parents are just so supportive. I just was amazed that here your parents, off you go and travel. And in fact, one time your dad, the only accommodations you could find involved your dad sleeping in a bathtub.
That was hilarious. The Dutch were so kind, and they had no other space. They finally said, I think we can make you a bed. And then they waited a little while and came and called us, and we all went in and looked at it and had a good laugh. But my father did sleep very well.
And maybe they missed where that was. You said the Dutch.
It was found in Giethoorn in the Netherlands.
Yeah, so you're traveling in the Netherlands, and so, okay, they were saying, well, we don't have any space. But you were willing to take, well.
Well, there was a bicycle race on, and every place in town was already fully accommodated. And I didn't want to drive any further. I was tired. It was the end of the day. We needed dinner and a bed.
Well, now, you mentioned you didn't want to drive more, because that's something, nowadays people might rent a car, and maybe only travel part of the time by car. You put a lot of miles on a car, and it wasn't a rental car. You would buy a car.
We bought the car.
And what was that car?
It was a Renault, and I think we paid $900 for it. And I drove it that summer, put 9,000 miles on it, took it under the agreement that Renault had with American purchasers. We could bring our car back to the dealer in Paris, and they would give us a good price for it. Well, I discovered that I could probably sell it on the street in front of American Express and do a little better, because it had no duty yet paid on it. Now it would be a used car. Anyone purchasing it would pay the duty on a car that had 90,000 miles already driven. So I was able to actually get full $900 back.
So you essentially got your car and didn't have to pay a rental fee.
Exactly.
For driving that, because you put in a lot of miles. It's been such a pleasure talking to you, Dr. Smith.
Thank you, Nancy.
Her book is Stereopticon, Entry to a Life of Travel and Tourism Research. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wiegman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.
Hi, this is Nolan Ford, audio producer for Nancy's Bookshelf. And I wanted to let you know that tomorrow night at the Villaine L. Smith Museum of Anthropology, NSPR members are invited to enjoy two exhibitions from 5:30 to 7 p.m. We hope to see you there.